Welcome to Cloud Native Startup, where we explore what it takes to build a company in the open source cloud native ecosystem.
I am Emily O'Meara, your host, and today I'm chatting with Kit Merker, who is one of the co-founders and chief operating officer at Noble 9. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Emily. Thanks for having me.
First question is if you could just introduce yourself. You have actually had a long, illustrious career in this ecosystem, so I'll let you tell listeners about it.
I'll try to give the short version of it. I've been in the software game for 20 plus years. I spent 10 of those at Microsoft building software for a variety of different use cases. Worked on Windows, Office 365, Azure, and Bing, which is a search engine, if you're not familiar. I also, in the cloud native space, got to work on the Kubernetes project at Google as a product manager back in the early days, 2014. So back when people barely knew how to spell Kubernetes and they didn't know about the eight in the middle. And worked on a bunch of different container stuff there, helped launch the CNCF, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, as part of that role. And then later I got to actually be on the governing board for the CNCF. So I got to work with lots of great folks in that community. And then I worked at JFrog, which is a developer tools company focused on artifact management. And now I'm here at Noble 9 building service level objectives in the observability space.
So there is something actually that you kind of glossed over, which is that at some point you went from being an engineer to more working on the business side. How did that transition happen? And maybe tell listeners a little bit more about when and why.
Sure thing. Yeah, it was a reluctant transition perhaps, but one that I eventually made. I started off writing code and building software and things like that, and then moved into more, you know, first it was moving into management types of roles, leading teams, and then moved more into more of the business side, as you pointed out. Well, there was actually a very precise moment that this happened in my career. So I'll give you a short little story on this. So I was at a large gathering at Microsoft, and there was a vice president speaking, and he talked about career. And so this was kind of the topic of the day, but it was a mixed audience. It was both, you know, kind of business, sales, marketing folks, and then also engineers, and all from the same sort of like level band in their career. And he said something really profound, at least that I found profound, which is that if you want to get the full experience, what he called the left to right experience of everything in the software business, you can't wait too long. You'll overspecialize and you'll become too ingrained and actually become too expensive for anyone to take a bet on you to try something new. And he said, everybody in this room is currently at that point in their career where if they wait any longer, they won't be able to switch to a different role. If you're an engineer, you won't be able to go to the business. If you're in the business, you won't be able to go into engineering. And it really hit me. And I literally not literally, but figuratively, I walked out of that room and I went and I found a job. And it's actually what I did. I went to a team at Microsoft called the Worldwide ISV, you know, Independent Software Vendor, ISV team, working on partnerships. And I found a manager who was willing to, he heard my story and he was willing to take a bet on me, even though I was coming in at a, you know, more senior level than most of the folks on the team. And I did an 18-month stint working on global partnerships for Microsoft. And I learned a ton about how it works. So it was a very intentional decision. And after that, I went and did engineering stuff for a couple of years before I kind of got into a little bit of everything. Product managers and other types of, you know, startup execs have to have that full picture, especially if you want to be, you know, kind of more in a general management or executive management role. You want to see the whole game. So that was kind of the experience I got. And doing that, you know, I think the story was true. And I've talked to a lot of engineers who, you know, have gone so far in their careers that it really would be a huge step back to get that, you know, kind of starting in the mailroom experience on the other side of the business.
That's a great story, by the way. I am curious though, what made you say, not only like, oh, I recognize that now is the time, but also that I would be missing out on something if I didn't also have this business side experience. I mean, there's plenty of people out there that are like, oh, well, that's, you know, I'll never miss that.
Yeah, it may be some sort of like naive and wild ambition or something. I don't know. I think for myself, especially earlier in my career, I really loved trying new things and learning. And I loved learning technology. I loved learning about lots of different topics, you know, music and economics and history. And, you know, there's just, you know, all sorts of different sciences. I'm a very kind of self-taught person. And so because of that, I also know for myself that experiencing things is really important. Now, I was scared. I was like completely afraid of this idea. I was running full steam ahead towards something that was absolutely frightening. And I don't know that I necessarily knew exactly what I was going to get myself into, but I kind of had the theory that, you know, I could always fall back onto an engineering role, that it wouldn't be the end of the world. And, you know, even if I completely crashed and burned, it wouldn't be career ending. So I think for myself, it was more curiosity and discovery than it was about any sort of actual, like, you know, oh, this is what I want to do long term. It was more like, what if there's something that, you know, that I miss that would be helpful? And by the way, I also thought it would be a good way to be more empathetic, more well-rounded as I work with people I didn't understand. And I think for many software, you know, or technology organizations, there really are two sides to the org. There's sort of like the nerds, and then there's like the morons or whatever. Like, this is how they kind of describe each other, right? Like the business people are a bunch of dummies that are like, you know, getting lucky at telling stories or whatever. And then the nerds are over here geeking out over, you know, technology, but they don't really understand people. I mean, this is sort of like the caricature of the organization. Well, of course, it's not even close to reality. And I think the more we can put ourselves into other people's position, the more we can learn about their experiences and their challenges, and the more we can create a well-functioning society and organization, a culture within your team or your company. And it all starts, you know, if you're going to build trust, which I think is the most important ingredient of any organization or any kind of human endeavor, is building trust between people. Empathy is really where it begins. And empathy, I believe, comes from experience. It doesn't come from just listening. Listening is important, but it's not, you know, it's not the whole game. The more we can experience it for ourselves, the more true and real that empathy becomes.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So bringing us back into the present, if we sort of connect the dots backwards, how did those 18 months that you spent working on partnerships, how did that influence the rest of your career? And, you know, how does that continue to influence what you're doing now?
Yeah, it's interesting how these things kind of play out. So, you know, I moved into, after running kind of the developer tools team for Bing for a couple of years, I moved into Google, joined the Kubernetes project. And my partnership experience was actually, I would say, incredibly valuable in that role. And one of the reasons was because our strategy for Kubernetes, you know, and my role specifically, was to make it ubiquitous. This was like the ambitious goal that we set for ourselves. It's like, let's make this into, if not the most important open source project, at least the most important cloud computing project. And at the time, you know, Docker and Mesos and all these other things were really starting to catch steam. And we had this like strangely named project that was just starting out. Well, so I applied my experience building partnerships, understanding, you know, the gives and gets, understanding how to broach a subject and to create a business opportunity for the other side, which is really what you want to do with partnerships. And so we went around to all the different companies that were, you know, now are, you know, CNCF members or other kinds of contributors to the project, relationships with people like, you know, Red Hat and Mirantis and Intel, and of course, CoreOS and, you know, all the other players, Mesosphere, right? All these companies that were trying to figure out how to operate. And I got to be the guy kind of like brokering those relationships and encouraging them to contribute, in some cases, contribute, you know, other open source projects, to build new things, to create marketing awareness and how it was going to benefit their business. And so building that coalition with different cloud providers, the different ISVs, the different services companies, you know, that whole food chain of the ecosystem, it's not just about, you know, getting developers into the mix. That's important, of course. But those developers that are contributing to the open source project and trying to use it for themselves, they're getting paid by somebody. And so if we can create a business interest for them and be able to articulate that well to them and to follow through on those commitments, right? That's really what it takes to build partnerships. And that was what I learned at Microsoft and then got to apply at Kubernetes and then have applied in every role since. And frankly, I mean, I've worked in business development and corporate development, which is just a fancy way of saying M&A, mergers and acquisitions. But, you know, business development, corporate development for JFrog, building the ecosystem there and acquiring companies. And so now at Noble 9, you know, I continue that. I'm, you know, leading our partnerships in addition to, you know, every other thing that I have going on. I'm, you know, leading our partnerships and helping build coalitions. We've built SLOconf, our SLO conference, you know, we ran last year and we got, you know, a number of great companies contributing to it. This year, we're going to go even bigger. And I'm all about building ecosystems and partnerships. And I think it comes back to that, you know, what we were talking about before, about empathizing, helping other people find, you know, how you can help them, help them fulfill their mission, help them gain traction or whatever it is that they're trying to accomplish. And also at the same time, you know, be a student together and learn together how to build better software, how to build better organizations. I think this is always the interesting part of the journey, is, you know, going with other people and learning from their interests and their background as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And you kind of glossed over it slightly. So in case listeners didn't pick up on it, you mentioned about how important it was to sort of build a coalition around Kubernetes to make it successful. And just, I just wanted to say, this is something that I hear repeatedly whenever I'm talking with people who have a very successful open source project that isn't just, you know, one company that basically like puts their code out in public, but it really is a joint effort. Like there's this massive effort that goes into coalition building.
Yeah, it's overhead. I mean, frankly, I mean, it's obviously much easier to be a dictator and tell everybody what to do and what the design should be. I mean, it's a much more costly proposition to build a true coalition. And it also requires some selflessness and some humility, which is hard. It's really hard. And it's especially difficult when you're a company like Google that, you know, has a reputation for, shall we say, arrogance and technical superiority, right? But then to go listen to how the real world works. And, you know, for me, when I got to spend time with some of our early adopters, I mean, and some of them were like maniacs. They were like running Kubernetes in production before 1.0. I mean, crazy, crazy people. And understanding their reasons. And what it turned out is like even our basic version of this open source project was better than what they had, you know, to work with, where they had a lot of manual tasks and things like this. So just the basic capabilities we gave them saved them from so much heartache and pain. And so then hearing these stories and then getting that feedback and the contributions and then seeing how these businesses, I mean, if you look at the basic proposition that we had for many of these service providers was, look, Google's going to be the cloud and we're going to build this to run the best kind of cloud operations, but we're going to make it so it can run anywhere. And by the way, it does run anywhere. It runs in AWS and it runs in Microsoft and it runs in Oracle and it runs on-prem. And so for a lot of these companies that we were working with, you know, sort of the Red Hats and IBMs and CoreOS's of the world, right? All these companies, you know, ranchers, et cetera, they were building infrastructure on the assumption that really Google was going to be more focused on cloud and they were going to have that last mile gap and there was going to be a business incentive to it, but they were going to gain a ton of value from the engineering know-how that Google developed over many years. And I, you know, I got so many people come to me and ask me how they could replicate Kubernetes success. And, you know, it was really tough. My best analogy is like, it's kind of like, you know, you stick your shovel in the ground and oil shoots out and you think, well, how do I get to replicate this? Well, it's really the dinosaurs that died that gave you that oil, right? It's not really anything that you did. And I actually think Kubernetes is kind of like that because of the years and years of large scale distributed systems development that happened to Google in the form of Borg and Omega. You know, that really was what inspired the project. And so the benefit was having gone through the hard work of seeing all the things that went wrong, the team that put it together, which by the way, many of them were the actual engineers that built that. So it's kind of, the analogy kind of falls apart. But the idea that you could just like, you know, conjure up a new piece of technology and turn it into this thing. And I think the combination of, you know, important technology at the right time with the right kind of ecosystem and the right technical leadership, that combination is a very rare thing to pull together. It's like, I don't know that it can be replicated, to be honest, but many have tried. But anyway, I think the point is that the coalition building, you know, you can't will it into existence. It has to be done through an understanding of mutual self-interest. It has to be done through patience, and you have to give something. You have to give something away, and you have to give away your time and energy to cultivate it and not just kind of like hope for the best. It's something that requires active work. And I think this goes back to what we're talking about with the kind of business technical divide, is that I think for many technical people, you know, technologists, developers, whatever you want to say, that haven't gone through that experience of building the customer development side of it, the demand side of it, the partnerships. If you haven't gone through that experience, it's kind of easy to hand wave at it and not realize the amount of effort and finesse and careful planning that goes into creating that kind of goodwill. And that's true of whether you're building a product or an open source project. I think it's really just, that is what the business is about. It's about bringing something of value to the right people. And it's harder than it looks.
Absolutely. I also think, you know, you mentioned people using Kubernetes when it was really like alpha, not really ready for production. And I think there's always some really interesting insights that you can draw from people who use a technology, a project, a product, when it's deficient in like 1,000 ways and they use it anyway. I think that's a really good sign for the product, because it means that whatever it is that it is doing right is like really, really critical.
Yeah, it helps you definitely clarify the core value. And I think a lot of times what we as product developers, right, creators of products, I think a lot of times we get trapped into the long feature list fallacy. And, you know, you can call it, you know, the MVPs or the minimal lovable product or whatever you want to call it, but there is something about creating the aha moment, right? The true differentiator. And usually, by the way, it's not something you expect. It's not the thing that you expected was going to be that moment of insight. It's usually something different. And once you discover that, though, and you can replicate that experience for many people, and then the rest becomes window dressing. Yes, of course, we must have security, and we just announced this morning we have SOC 2 at Noble 9. You must have these things, right? You must have RBAC and, you know, backup strategies and whatever, deployment and documentation. You got to have all this stuff. And that's part of, you know, the complexity of building, you know, especially a software and infrastructure business. Oh my God, it's like, there's just so much you have to do to fill in the gaps to make it easy. But at the end of the day, the core value, right, that core differentiation from the old way, right, status quo, the way you did it before, the thing you used to waste your time doing, have endless meetings about, et cetera, that suddenly became instantaneously solved. To me, this is what is the magic of software, generally speaking. Like the idea that, you know, you might have an abacus or a slide rule, and then all of a sudden you have a calculator. You know what I mean? Like there's this amazing thing that happens. And the software that we have now is taking so much of that toil off our plates. And of course, you know, opening up new opportunities for us to do higher order things. But this is like in the software business, this is why I get excited by software all the time, is that it takes things that we did before and it shows us how ridiculously easy it can become if you have an elegant, automated software way of solving the problem. And I think right now, when we look at the cloud native ecosystem in particular and where things are trending, what we're really seeing is software being applied to building software. And I think this is like the next frontier that is happening right now. This is the wave we're on right now. And the transition from, you know, line of business, enterprise deployed applications to SaaS software for everything. And, you know, all these moves that are happening to make the software development process, you know, we just expect people to have DevOps and CI/CD. This is stuff that like didn't exist 10 years ago, wasn't mainstream 10 years ago at all. And it's just an expectation now. And this is continuing this push toward higher levels of productivity and feature delivery. Of course, the downside of it is, meanwhile, all of our engineering friends are overworked, burnt out on technical debt, and quitting their jobs. So there's something to be said about, you know, understanding the true cost, if you will, of the state of software development, that we still have a long way to go in really finding the right level of efficiency, delivery speed, quality, reliability, security, all these things that are stretching us all out all the time. This is also, you know, equally as important, if not more important, than the features themselves. And so if you can kind of think about that core value and then some of the must-haves in order to do business, and then the pieces that make sure that the engineering teams are productive and also sustainable, I think this is really this is the formula. This is the checklist that I think about now from a product development, like what you need in order to go be successful.
It's really interesting what you're saying about developer burnout. This is total conjecture, but I do sometimes wonder if all this sort of obsession with developer productivity is part of it. I mean, you don't generally hear, well, and also that it's easier to like granularly measure it. So a developer might say, you know, I write X number of lines of code or something like that. Like you wouldn't have that granular of a measurement for a business person generally, any kind of business person.
Well, to be fair, like salespeople are definitely measured in a very specific way. And there are ways of quantifying the hour, you know, billable hours and things like this for different kinds of professions. So there definitely is, I think, in our modern, maybe American mindset, you know, there is a quantification, productivity orientation, right? And we have this, if you're familiar with the Taylorist way of thinking about productivity, that, you know, you want to eliminate all the waste and you want to create this minimal inputs to maximize your ROI. Which, you know, when we think about creative fields and we think about the way that creative work is done, it's actually not the right environment for it. And a lot of times, almost exclusively, product development and software is actually a creative task and not a rote mechanical task. So we want to create an environment, I think, for freedom of expression and creativity and for even just, you know, some serendipity to happen, right? The inspiration to strike so that we can have our moments of I know for me as a programmer back many years ago when I used to write code, I would put on the headphones and when I felt inspired, I would crank for hours and then I would sometimes just put it off and procrastinate. And that was, you know, I think it's very similar to writing or other kinds of tasks like that. But your point about productivity obsession, I think it is really harmful, actually. And I think it's especially harmful for engineers that are under a lot of pressure to deliver features, because feature pressure is where all of your technical debt comes from. And technical debt is what accrues over time to ruin engineering organizations and ultimately product businesses in general.
Yeah. Well, let's step back a little bit from the theoretical discussion and tell me a little bit more about Noble 9. Particularly what I'm always interested in knowing is, like, how did this company come to be? You know, how did you decide that this was the time to start a new company? And you'd always been at big companies rather than, you know, a series of startups. So what made you want to do the startup thing?
Well, I guess just glutton for punishment, I guess. Well, the origin story is kind of interesting. So while I was at Google working on all the container stuff, you know, I went off to the side and did a little stint working on Marketplace. Marketplace, if you're familiar with cloud marketplaces, essentially what it is, it's a way to deploy applications into the cloud and to handle transactions, you know, for a variety of partners. And so this kind of was good fit for me, as I had experience with this. And what I was trying to do was to build a container-based marketplace. This is what I really wanted to do. And in the course of understanding what we had in the technology and working on this, I figured out pretty quickly that we needed to move a bit faster in growing it. And so I ended up leading an acquisition of a company called Orbitera. And Orbitera was an amazing fit for Google Cloud, helped us accelerate much, much faster in marketplace, get tons of apps in, built great infrastructure. Well, Brian Singer and Marcin Kurtz were the founders at Orbitera, and they're also the founders at Noble 9. So, you know, coincidence there. Well, I left not long after the acquisition closed to join a company called JFrog, and I did that for a while. And that was kind of a startup. I was like 140 employees or so when I joined, but it was not nearly as early. Well, Brian and Marcin had just an amazing experience at Google and integrating Orbitera into the company. You know, they had to go through this technology integration. And one of the things that happened is, as you know, Brian kind of tells the story, is like he went to meet with the SRE team, the site reliability engineering team at Google. And they said, well, where are your SLOs? And he goes, well, I don't know what SLOs are. I have SLAs. I don't know what SLOs are. And he learned about service level objectives, which is this very elegant approach to measuring and managing customer expectations, risks, and trade-offs as a way of building shared context between service teams, and actually lets you move a lot of arguments, negotiations, and meetings into APIs, which is a very cool outcome of this. Anyway, Brian got hooked on the concept. And after 3 years there building this integration, he thought, wow, this would be a great next company, is to take this concept, which was only available really as a book at this point. You know, the SRE book laid out the SLO concept very clearly. And he wanted to see if we could build something. So we got the band back together and we went out and raised a little money and we started to see if there was a market for it. And it turns out there's an amazing market for service level objectives. And the reason is because every company of a given size, right, is delivering more and more via software. And by the way, accelerated by COVID, unfortunately, but accelerated because so many businesses went from having storefronts to being purely digital. And digital businesses need to think about customer service differently. You know, if you walk into a restaurant, you know, we can tell the server, okay, you need to greet people this quickly, you need to do this, you need to do that, you should check in on them this many times. And it's a person who's using their judgment to figure out what the service level should be for that customer. Well, not so in the cloud, not so in a mobile app, right? We have to tell the software. And so we can't expect perfection. It's very expensive. Perfection is maybe the most expensive thing available, and it's not even really available. It's not really obtainable. So if we want something less than perfection, what we want to do is define very specifically what our goals are. If we say, you know, should it work 1 out of 100 times? That would be 99% SLO. If it can work 1 out of 1,000, right? 99.9%. And this idea that you set a specific goal, well, it gives you another tool, which is what we call an error budget. And the error budget is basically the remainder between 100% and the SLO. So if I say 99, then my error budget is 1. And it's kind of a strange little trick, but by flipping the goal into reverse, instead of saying, I want it to be this reliable, we say, okay, this is our acceptable level of unreliability. By measuring that, it informs us in a very different way about the service. And so with this product development, we had a vision for what we wanted to build, and we also knew that we couldn't build it in a vacuum. And so part of the divide and conquer we went through was I focused my energy on learning about the real world of the market. And I figured the best way to do that was to teach people how to do it. Because, you know, I think for learning, you know, teaching is maybe the most effective way. You know, you want to experience it, you want to teach it. So I figured out how to be an SLO bootcamp instructor. I made my own curriculum. I did a bunch of research. I learned from some existing curriculums that were out there, but I built my own kind of approach to it. And I got to spend 18 months basically meeting with engineering teams and helping them figure out how to define SLOs. And I did this with a number of great companies. Can't unfortunately talk about who they are, but gaming companies, banks, telecom companies, payments processors, just a ton of companies. And I would bring these teams together, five to seven people, all over Zoom, and bring them through this discovery process. And the outcome was they had a set of metrics, goals, and a reliability roadmap for how they were going to improve their service. And this is a very fulfilling experience for me. Now, bringing this back to the product team, right? We were able to iterate quickly and understand the things that truly mattered to these teams and help them fit this into the product, and also gave us a nice, healthy marketing pipeline, right, of people who are interested in what we had to offer. And so that's really where it started. The last couple of years has been all about gaining traction with customers, building the product and getting different certifications and features and documentation, all this kind of stuff going. But it's been an incredibly rewarding experience, starting from literally nothing to now having almost 100 people in the company and dozens of customers and a healthy, healthy pipeline ahead of us. It's exciting.
So when you were teaching SLO classes, were you charging people for those classes?
I charged a couple of times, but mostly not. I was mostly doing it for free. One we did in person that had some expenses. We had to cover some of those expenses. And then we've had a couple where we added additional bootcamp training as part of a platform purchase. So when they bought our SLO platform, we would add on some bootcamps for that. But otherwise, no, I didn't charge for it because I wanted people to, I mean, I was benefiting from it more than they were, to be honest, because I was learning so much about how this works in the real world.
Yeah, I was just curious because I think that's a fabulous strategy. And I know some companies that have sort of started out as consultants, really as a way to sort of bootstrap their product. But it sounds like a very unique way to approach the problem of doing customer interviews. And also like providing the customers or potential customers with something of value at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. And so the challenge with being a consultant first, I think, is that a couple issues with it. One is you can get addicted to the revenue. This is the first problem. This you can sort of like start earning some good cash doing consulting, and you may kind of lose sight of the product. And if you're really trying to build a large scale product company, you know, well, we're swinging for the fences here. I mean, we're not trying to be too ambitious, but we are, you know, defining a category. We're building something unique, and we think, you know, our investors are expecting us to bring home something successful. So we want to swing for the fences here. We're building a product company. That's the idea. So if I had gone out and said, oh, well, I'm going to go do billable work, consulting work, I think it would have distracted from that goal. Now, I know that is a viable strategy, and I've talked to many companies that have used that consulting approach. But that is one of the big challenges, is that, you know, divorcing yourself from the revenue. The second problem is that it also disqualifies many companies that wouldn't be willing to pay for the session. And so to your point about what I was really getting was customer interviews, right? I was developing a deeper understanding of what was really going on with these different teams and what was really affecting them with the reliability journey, what was really the challenge. And what I witnessed firsthand were teams that had been working together for, in some cases, years, and had never had a real conversation about the reliability of their service. They'd actually never talked about it. And it was astounding. I didn't believe that it was going to happen. I never would have guessed that I would walk into these rooms and they literally had never talked about this before, and not in any way that was actually productive. And seeing that, it made me realize some things about the product, about how it needed to work, and which we iterated on, and we made it much, much easier to do the sharing and, you know, have read-only users and different groupings of our SLOs. Getting the SLOs encoded and checked into source control is such an important part of this, because we can't have disagreement about the current SLO. We can disagree about what the SLO should be, but we can't have disagreement about what the SLO is right now. Well, if that's checked into source control, then we know where the source of the truth is and there's no disagreement, right? We're moving meetings to APIs. This is an important concept. If you exclude different roles because you say, well, this is really a developer tool, then you miss something important, because this is a business context tool. This is about understanding and ratifying our expectations of the service in terms of what we want from customers. Well, if the business doesn't have a seat at the table, if they can't understand what you're talking about, they can't log into the tool because it's considered too complicated, or because the user licensing precludes them from having access, I mean, that then becomes a non-starter, right? So when you think about the actual day-to-day use of the product and you see the absence of the product, kind of what you were pointing out about like seeing people using a product before it's really ready, you witness the absence of the product, and then you can see how you can eradicate all of the useless negotiation, toil, conversations, meetings, frustration. You can remove all of it with a simple and elegant solution built in software. And it may seem counterintuitive that like your software doesn't have to do it all. Like just do one thing really super well. That's all you need to do. I mean, it's kind of like the Twilio strategy. You know, it's like just do one thing and do it super well. Don't sell people it's an end-to-end platform. Don't sell people that it's like, you know, whiz bang, going to do everything, sprinkle some AI on it. It's going to make everything better. But deliver that nugget of value and do it in a way that hits people where they are and solves a problem that they've been facing every single day, but they've never really been able to even discuss. And that is what, amazingly, I'm shocked. This is where we found ourselves. This is what we've done. We've done this with service level objectives. We've made it so that the observability and monitoring systems people have can become actionable. It's not just reporting. It's really about automation. It's checked in. So it's a single source of truth. Business people and technical people can both understand it. And it reduces the amount of time spent thinking about reliability to a fraction of the amount of time and lets you do things like, you know, better planning. So you can avoid burning out your team. You can see when technical debt is actually hurting you. So you can focus on fixing reliability as opposed to just delivering more features and creating more technical debt. All of these things, I mean, that's why I get so excited by it, because my entire career building software, this is exactly what we were facing. And we had a luxury at Google, to be very honest. Like Google had a big luxury because the strangest thing, Google, who created so much of this great documentation and concepts around SLOs, they have a unique challenge that most companies don't have. And I actually have never run into it anywhere else. At Google, the engineers will over-engineer their infrastructure so much, they create this gold-plated infrastructure for everything. And they actually have to use the SLOs as a way to tone down the reliability. I mean, you've heard these stories where they actually literally burn the air budget. They bring their services down intentionally so that other services don't overly rely on them being too perfect, right? This is like if you go to an enterprise and you explain this story, they think you're absolutely bonkers. They think you're mad. And when you talk to any enterprise in the world that's not Google, with some exceptions, I'm sure that, you know, Facebook and a few others could throw themselves into this category too. You know, I know at Microsoft, I had some experiences of over-engineering. But most enterprises you talk to, their challenge is they can't get the service to be reliable enough. They have no idea what this whole idea of like, oh, we need to reduce the reliability of the service because it's too reliable. That's just like a foreign concept. Well, it turns out SLOs and error budgets are still useful in that situation. It's not only for services that are 5.9s, but it's also useful for services that are, you know, 1.8. Like, you know, that's fine too. It doesn't need to be high reliability. What we're looking for is clarity, right? It's not about trying to make things perfect. It's about being very clear about the trade-offs so that you can engineer and make better decisions. This is what it's all about. And I think it really, for me, changes the way I approach software development. It completely changes the way I think about software delivery and roadmap planning. And that to me is like the exciting part of what we're doing. So anyway, sorry for the long diatribe there, but that's SLOs.
I love it. I actually had never heard the phrase error budget. And I really like that, particularly the budget part, because it does get you away from thinking about perfection. And, you know, there's really like no area of life where perfection is realistic. And I think acknowledging that and like recognizing what your margin is seems like a very healthy way to approach it. And we were talking about burnout, like a psychologically healthy way, as well as then ultimately resulting in applications that are as reliable as they actually need to be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the error budget terminology, I think it's both a fantastic idea. And once you hear it, you'll never go back. You see error budgets everywhere. But it's also a term that's slightly wonkishly confusing for people because it's not literally a budget. And what do we really mean by an error? But conceptually, right? And we had this like joke on Twitter about coming up with new names for it. I think somebody called it like boo boo bucks, and excess excellence is one of the phrases I like. But it's this idea that there is a gap between what's excellent, what's reasonable, what's actually good, and what's perfection. And perfection is, like you said, it's unobtainable. It's psychologically damaging, right? Like, look, we, you know, we're we see perfection in Instagram models, right? And like, who wants to be like that, right? So I think this is a very important part, and it models life. And if you think about software, you know, oftentimes we think of software as very binary, right? Either it works or it doesn't. And in distributed systems, cloud computing, the internet, that's not how it works. It works some of the time. We all have experienced this, right? You get buffering, you get, the page didn't load, you get a random 404, you get all kinds of weird things that happen. You have to check your Wi-Fi, right? And we all know it's not the end of the world. I mean, so if you kind of imagine this, like, you know, wheel that you spin every time you load a website, right? There's 100 slices on this imaginary wheel. And 99 of them say that the web page loads correctly. Well, Emily, what does the last slice say?
I don't know. Well, my current software error is my father has dementia. He has this special device for people with dementia. And he's able to, there's like some restrictions. But anyway, so every time he sends an email, it gets sent out like every 5 minutes or every like 1 minute. So I've been getting like 500 emails a day from him recently.
Oh, wow.
So I guess that's not a web page issue, but that's when you're talking about like software errors, and the company's been working on it for like a week.
Oh my God.
That's the one that comes up to me.
That's a great one. Well, so this hypothetical wheel you spin, it has 99 slices to say web page loads. The last slice, what we think it says is that there's a failure, right? That's what we think is like, oh, that's bankrupt, right? Fail. But in reality, it says spin again. And that is just that simple. It's what we have all been trained to do is that if it doesn't work, you try it again. You try to upload a check, doesn't work the first time, you try it again. Guess what? It's probably going to work, right? You try to stream a movie, doesn't work. You restart it, you try it again. And there's an expectation that we have of real behavior. And so if I'm a business and I'm offering this service, my expectations are going to be driven by the state of technology and my competitors. And so my goal is really to build an efficient system that serves my customers at the level of expectations they have, maybe a little bit better, keep pushing it forward, but it doesn't need to be 1,000 times better than my competitors or even 100 times better. It needs to be good enough that people will continue to use the service. If you mess up enough, then they'll leave. So what we're getting at here with this SLO concept and error budgets is it's grounded in human behavior, right? It's modeling the business because yeah, it would be great to go and invest infinite money into building, you know, the perfect software, but it's not feasible. And I have to serve the interests of the employees, the interests of my customers, and the interests of the business stakeholders. And if I can't do that, then I'm going to be out of business pretty quick. So with everything from, you know, your dad's software with the emails to, you know, websites we use, whatever, we cope with it. We live with this imperfect world. And yet I think so often, as you were kind of alluding to, we expect perfect software from our engineers. And we expect them to be on call, ready to respond to incidents. We expect them to write perfect tests and documentation, to be able to, you know, understand code they wrote a year ago. And those expectations are really, I think, out of whack relative to the expectations that, you know, our end customers have. Now, like, I'm all for quality and building great software and everything. I believe that we want to push software forward. It already has moved forward. It moves forward on its own. We see it happening because the market forces and the technology forces move us forward, not backwards. And the quality that we experience today, the level of efficiency, reliability, security, et cetera, is completely, you know, on a different planet from where we were 5 or 10 years ago. So that march forward will continue and it will never achieve perfection.
So going back to this idea of founding a startup and what you think has gone well, what you think hasn't gone well. So first of all, you know, if I ever found a startup, I'm going to rip off your idea of doing those workshop sessions. I think it's excellent. But my last question, actually, because we'll wrap up after this, but is just like, what do you think has gone well? What are some mistakes you think you've made? What advice would you give to somebody who's about to embark on their first startup adventure?
Well, every day is an adventure. I think the biggest thing in building a new, not everybody's building a new company, but whether you're building a new product, entering a new market, you know, even thinking about a new job, right? When you're doing something new and you're bringing other people along with it, I think what's maybe the most important thing is prioritization. How you think about your use of time, your use of resources, and really starting to use, you know, almost like a ruthless level of prioritization about what's going to matter and what's going to give me the validation to move forward as quickly and as cheaply as possible. We want to iterate, right? We're learning something new. We're trying something new. We want to iterate and get as many iterations as we can that give us that kind of like reinforcement learning, which means that, you know, yeah, it would be nice to have, you know, X, Y, and Z, you know, whatever, but you got to do kind of the lifeboat test and say, well, if this thing doesn't work out, then we're completely out of luck. And if this other thing doesn't, then we're there. I mean, the biggest things that hurt startups, you know, number one, is there a market? Is there really a market? Is it really big enough for you to go win that market, right? This is, I think, one of the big challenges. Second is, can you deliver on your promise, right? Can you actually build the thing? Do you have the capability to build the thing? And then after that, everything else is about talent. I mean, it's kind of crazy. I hate to boil it down that much, but like, if you can understand the market opportunity and you can deliver on the promise it takes, that core value, like we talked about, core value plus the, you know, the business checklist plus the reliability, security, and the basics, if you can deliver on that, then everything after that becomes about finding and attracting the right talent to the company. And if you do that correctly, and you do that with the right level of diversity and differing opinions and backgrounds, and you get people excited by that mission, then the rest kind of starts to unfold. And that's where I think it gets really exciting, is to see how things in a company unfold on their own. And the best ideas come from these people, because the mission is clear, the market is clear, and everything else. And look, it's not easy. There's a million mistakes you make along the way, but being very guarded about how you spend your time and resources, and always pushing it toward this idea that you need to find the market, or the market will develop. You have to time it, and you have to build something of extreme value for a lot of people when you're building a company from nothing. And again, it applies, I think, to product development. It can even apply to, I think, career development too. When you think about, like, I want to try something new for myself. I want to embark on a new career. How are you going to gain the experience and the validation? This is something you really want to do. You know, you want to do that quickly and iteratively, and not fall into the traps of, you know, bias and hypotheses, the untested hypotheses. I think a lot of entrepreneurship is kind of like a science experiment. You know, you want to test the market, you want to test the ideas, and the more you can get feedback and assess the patterns of that feedback, I think the more likely you can be successful in whatever venture you're going after. So there you go. There's my advice.
Fabulous. And where can listeners go to learn more, or to connect with you, or to follow you?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Kit Merker. I'm also, noble9.com is a great place. We have tons of educational resources, by the way, on our blog. We have tons of videos up there, interviews with reliability experts and other folks. We have SlowConf Monthly, which I definitely recommend checking out. And we have SlowConf, the annual conference, which is coming up May 9th through 12th this year. And it's going to be fully virtual. Attend while you work. It's free. And last year, we had 7 hours of content on SLOs. This year, with the CFP, the call for papers, is still open. So we just extended it by a week. So if anybody wants to submit a talk, actually, I don't know when this is going live, but assuming that it's still open, you go ahead and submit a talk. And if not, definitely register for SlowConf. You can learn everything about SLOs. And even if you don't think, you know, a platform is right for you, and you're not interested in buying our product, that's okay. Like, we're just here to help teach people about SLOs and error budgets and how to make their services better and work better with people and avoid technical debt, burnout, and all those things that are plaguing the software industry right now. So yeah, those are ways to find me and get in touch.
Excellent. Fabulous. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Emily.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Cloud Native Startup. If you'd like to learn more about positioning, messaging, and go-to-market for open source and cloud native startups, head over to my blog, positioningopensource.com. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Emily O'Meara, and you can feel free to reach out on Twitter or on my website and blog with questions or comments. If you enjoyed this episode, also please share and help more people discover this podcast. Thank you, and we hope to have you next week.